Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Piotr Bukanski. Piotr is an investment manager at Berenger. Originally from Poland, Piotr lived in Latvia, Sweden, Germany, and is currently based in the UK. With a background in finance, he spent 5 years at Merrill Lynch, where he worked on major deals across consumer retail and later helped build a team that was providing fundraising advisory on $50 million plus deals to high growth companies. Now with over 3 years at Berenger, Piotr is a generalist investor who spends most of his time in B2B, data, climate tech, and fintech. He backed companies like Gorilla and Iceberg Data Lab. He also set up a CEE Diaspora VC and Founders Network in London. In today's episode, we talked about the fact that at growth, investment banking skills are transferable. At early stage, not so much. How you're paid to take risk and make investments as a VC, so you better get comfortable with failure. And why it's easier to transition from consumer to B2B than the other way around as an investor.
It feels like it's a little bit easier to transition from consumer to B2B than the other way around.
How you want your funnel of companies to be as large as possible, which is where generalists win, but that you can become a specialist generalist in any sector. Why you need to understand who else is around the table when you're sat on the board, and how you need to be vulnerable as an investor, because it can only help founders make the right decisions.
With possible vulnerable relationship with a founder, which I love to have.
Why climate tech infrastructure projects don't follow the cash profile you want as a VC, and how there's a very negative narrative around the European IPO market at the moment.
Negative narrative around Europe is very similar to IPO market.
And why there's a plethora of reasons why companies are listing in the US and not Europe, but culture is probably the biggest one.
Ultimately, people are picking the US market.
Why we need to provide a pipeline of companies into the public market, and Piotr's contrarian conviction in ice hockey, the New York Rangers are going to make it to the finals.
I do believe New York Rangers will make it to playoffs this year.
Let's get straight into it. Hey guys, whilst I've got you for a moment, I thought I'd introduce myself. My name's Arish. I'm the host of Nothing Ventured, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture ecosystem go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from seed to Series B and beyond. If you like the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe and rate wherever you listen. And if there's anything you want to talk to me about, please do feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Right, let's get straight into it. Piotr, great to have you here in the studio with me. Thank you so much for joining.
Pleasure to be here, folks. Thanks for the invite.
No problem at all. Well, look, we talked a little bit about this in the quickfire, but I'd love to understand your kind of journey, right? Because transitioning from investment banking to venture capital can be quite challenging. What are the things you had to unlearn from your time in IB or learn from scratch even to build up your skill set within venture?
Yeah, it's been quite a transition. And if you think about it kind of outside in, you'd probably say it's the most natural transition really to make, going from banking to venture, but it's not necessarily the case. There are indeed a few things you have to unlearn, probably way more learns that you have to learn. It also depends, you know, how early do you go in venture on, or where on the kind of within venture you actually enter. If you go to growth kind of Series B plus, probably a lot of your skill set that you bring from banking, exactly, the kind of technical skill set, financials and so on, work pretty well. You also probably, a lot of people in growth will be ex-banking, so it will be very similar type of people you'll be working with, way more focus on financials overall. If you look at the other side of the spectrum, kind of early stage, kind of pre-seed or seed, I think that's a completely different job. Ultimately, there maybe will be some things that you pick up, but ultimately, I do believe it's a different job. And where I went ultimately, which is kind of Series A, B, it's in between, right? Mm. There are things you can utilize and skill set that are helpful, but there are also plenty of things you have to unlearn. And yeah, happy to talk through a few of them.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would imagine the main thing being no data, right? Like, so talk me through that, because I mean, obviously in investment banking, you're spending a lot of your time looking at real data, real numbers, doing DCFs and figuring out kind of, the present value of future cash flows, which is the way you value a business, I guess, in investment banking and investment more generally, but at early stage, that's next to impossible. So yeah, how did you approach that, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you should value every single business like that. You just can't do it. Yeah, I think first thing to learn was to get used to imperfect information and not having data. As you say, right, you don't have perfect 5 years of audited financials you can look at. You don't have investor presentations every quarter, transcripts, equity research reports. There is none of it. So just, you know, getting used to the fact that there is no data takes time to adjust. Mm. It's a journey, it's a learning. You get used to it, right? Like the models you look at are not perfect effectively. You're always missing some data. You get used to it. But what that kind of drives you to or maybe is, what that leads to is that ultimately you operate in this kind of constant uncertainty, whereby in banking it's all about control. You know a lot of things, and if you don't know something, you will find a variable that you need to make a specific decision. Mm-hmm. In venture, I feel like we constantly operate in uncertainty, and it's like a new way of working. You really have to get used to it.
Mm. I mean, I guess, you know, I think about this quite a lot because obviously coming from a finance sort of background myself, yeah, you're steeped in numbers, you're steeped in, you know, what you can see and what you can report. And, you know, when I started making very small angel kind of investments, you have to get used to the fact that you're not making a decision based on, you're not making a decision based on necessarily data from within the business. You're looking at data outside the business, but actually more than anything else, you're making a decision based on your assumptions of where the business could go. And that's driven more by, can the team execute? Is this a market that has substantial value? Is there something proprietary within the tech that you can see, right? And essentially what you're backing is the potential, not the actual, right?
Yeah, 100%. I think what you might be pointing to, or what I would think is also something you have to unlearn, linked to it, is just switching your mindset from short term to long term. Mm. And like you're in this constant kind of flow of quarterly results, if you think about public companies, but even for private companies, yeah, right? You get the numbers quite regularly. You think in those short-term time periods. You go to venture, you have to extend your kind of the way of thinking to long-term. You, as you said, use a lot of external information. You have to get used to speaking with experts, speaking with ecosystem, which is different. But, you know, it takes a little bit of time, but you can easily adjust to it if you want to.
Yeah. And so now, I guess, with the benefit of hindsight, do you prefer the uncertainty of early stage, or do you index more towards kind of the certainty of the later stage growth kind of metrics?
I wouldn't say I prefer one of the other. You just find yourself in a specific setting and you embrace it and get used to it and work within it. I definitely prefer right now working with earlier stage companies. I very much, you know, love my job. I probably would do that regardless if I had to or not had to work to an extent, right? I just really like that job. I've embraced uncertainty and I'm getting more and more comfortable with it.
Yeah. And I think that's actually the key point, right? It's getting comfortable with that uncertainty. And I think it can be very exciting, right? The point in venture is that you take a lot of bets, you know, the usual sort of narrative around power law, right? You need enough bets to find the one that is going to really scale and outperform. But the point is not that you're taking lots of bets hoping that one of those will. It's that you're taking lots of bets that all have the potential to, at least in your opinion, have the potential to outperform, but with the certain knowledge that the likelihood is that the majority of them won't, for whatever reason, right? And there's plenty of reasons why A, B, or C business isn't going to become a fund returner. But the point is you're always making the investment on the basis that it could, which means, you know, the thing that I think is really difficult is it means that you have to, you know, obviously with investment, there's lots of reasons to say no. Yeah. But actually, at very early stage, you've got to, there's a million reasons to say no at early stage, right? The founder doesn't have the pedigree or hasn't had enough experience or doesn't have a co-founder or whatever it might be that is kind of in your sort of checkbox list for what a founding team should look like. Or it could be that you haven't had experience of the market before. It could be just a plethora of reasons, but actually your job as a VC, I guess, is to find the reason why to say yes, rather than to say no, right? Like, is there something that you're missing that in your knowledge is not there, and that if you could find that reason, actually it makes sense to make the investment. Now, obviously there are lots of businesses where you can go through that process and still come back with a no, but I think, you know, it's more about finding a reason why to invest than why not to invest, right?
That's fair. And I guess you can always find a reason at early stage not to invest. Also linking back to the uncertainty, imperfect numbers, and so on. But you're also touching upon a quite interesting point there. Apart from switching your thinking or mindset from short-term to long-term, moving from banking to venture, you also kind of switch your mindset from, you know, in banking as an advisor, you look at the good things in the business. Mm-hmm. You think through equity story, how do we sell this? Meantime, when you go to venture, you actually over-index on red flags and mm-hmm. the things that might not go well. You need to find them first. You need to feel comfortable with those risks. So you identify the risk versus the upsides ultimately. And then obviously there is enough upside for you to feel comfortable that this business, this investment can make return that works. Another point that you mentioned is you said you make an investment, right? Mm. I.e. you make a decision. Mm. In banking, you don't really make decisions. Mm. You provide an advice. You give a kind of menu of options. In your situation, you can do A, B, C, or D.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, the call is made by your customer, by a client. In venture, you're paid to have an opinion. You're paid to make decisions.
You're paid to allocate.
Which is something you have to learn, exactly. Yeah. And the second point to that, in banking, like, you cannot fail, as in you can fail, but no one welcomes a failure. So you have to learn to be comfortable with failure. And especially on early stage, so many companies will ultimately go to zero.
Yeah.
This is a completely new feeling for someone who hasn't allocated capital before. Like, you make a call A, you make a decision, two, it can go to zero. That's all new.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a really critical point, right? Is being able to internalize the fact that 90% of the things that you look at, well, maybe not quite 90%, but a large proportion of the investments that you make are likely to go to zero, or, you know, at best they're going to kind of chug along and not really return anything or anything substantial. And, you know, I mean, it's one of the reasons I love ventures, because you are forced to get outside of your comfort zone and actually take risk, right? Which ultimately venture is the riskiest, asset class kind of out there. I mean, okay, one could argue that there are other risky assets out there, but, you know, certainly not mainstream. And you are, I mean, the reason you see such incredible upside in venture is because you are taking risks, you know, the biggest risk at the earliest stage of a business. But that failure, I mean, in the US, I would say that the failure is kind of worn as a badge, right? Like, whereas I think in Europe, we still struggle a little bit with that, just more culturally. I'm not saying necessarily in venture itself, but just, you know, you're always going to see the articles that, well, you know, it's a bit like the future fund, right? For example, the narrative is all, well, you know, 6% of the future fund has failed. And it's like, well, yeah, but that's still 94% that haven't yet. And just one of those or two of those could end up, you know, being an incredible benefit to the UK, to the tax take, to the fund, the future fund itself. So I think it is one of the extraordinary things, because it actually allows you to explore a lot more, because you're not bound by facts in the same way that you are, or data, as we said, in the same way that you are either in investment banking or later stage investing. You are bound by the limits of your own imagination, right? And I think that's what's incredible. I want to kind of switch a little bit. You initially focused on consumer retail when you're in investment banking. So how did you shift your approach and mindset when you transitioned to B2B investments as a VC, particularly in areas like data, climate tech, and fintech, all of which, you know, again, just to our earlier point, right, some of these climate tech especially is a very long-term kind of play. Data is an area that's changing, and obviously AI has changed things a lot. And fintech, of course, you know, there are lots of fintechs out there. One could argue maybe there are too many doing much the same thing. But, you know, I, for example, because I've always worked in B2B environments, whether that's in manufacturing, whether that's in tech, whether that's elsewhere, consumer is something I find really hard to get my head around. And in fact, you know, I remember I had a conversation with a CFO that I know who is very much steeped in consumer. I said, like, how do you know what she goes? She said to me, you know, because I've been doing it for 20 years, I have a gut feeling now about which brand is going to be successful, what is going to work, what isn't going to work. I think that might be slightly harder in B2B because you're not, you are really looking at solutions to enterprise problems as opposed to, is Johnny on the street going to buy this product and does it have value? So yeah, how did you find that whole transition?
Yeah, so I would say in general, I'm a generalist investor, right? So I would cover both B2C and B2B, which was a good transition from doing consumer and retail only or kind of high growth consumer to both of the sectors. But indeed, I think you're right. The reference you made makes sense or resonates. It feels like it's a little bit easier to transition from consumer to B2B than the other way around. Mm. There are some things you can pick up from consumer that ultimately will be relevant also in B2B. I mean, ultimately, user has to use the product. There has to be a specific engagement with your audience. And there are things that are different too. I think ultimately, there are, you know, common traits across businesses, whether they're B2B or B2C.
Of course.
Where you have a good, you know, good business and you approach it in a very similar way.
You're looking at similar sort of metrics around cash, you know, around cash generation, value accretion, LTV, CAC, all of those sort of things can be common.
Yeah, in a different way, but you do. And by the way, you mentioned a few metrics, which ultimately links back to financials, right? And then links back to a little bit of banking background as well. You have that skill set coming out of banking to assess any business looking through financials, which is a very helpful first step, whether it's B2C or B2B, right? Then ultimately, you know, B2B SaaS, let's say, is not a rocket science when it comes to metrics. It's something you can pick up very quickly. The more time you spend in that space, the faster you learn about it. What's different is, as you say, you're thinking about a problem and a solution.
Yeah.
Does this specific product solve that specific problem? Sales cycles are different. Sales behaviors are different. You have to get used to it. You have to understand it better. I think it takes time, right? It comes with experience. You switch your thinking a little bit. The other thing is, as you mentioned, right? Market sizing will work very similarly, whether it's a B2C business or B2B. I mean, you'll go through an exercise. Of course, there will be ultimately different customer type, but there is a customer type. You'll be assessing a founder through kind of the same lens or a similar lens. And then ultimately, yes, consumer is fairly intangible. Probably the more you do it, the more of a gut feeling you get around power of brand, around whether it sells, why it sells, what are the trends out there. I think the more embedded you are in that environment, the better you become, and it takes time. B2B, I believe I found it slightly different. And then you linked to, you know, data, fintech, and climate, which I tend to spend most of my time. On data and fintech side, I think there was always a link, as in coming out of banking, you're ultimately a user of data platforms.
Yeah.
You know how selling to financial institutions work because you are one, you are the customer. So there is a kind of some of a common ground of understanding. It was much easier to step into that space just based on your experience. It doesn't matter whether I did consumer, industrials, or, you know, banking sectors while at the bank. And then when it comes to climate itself, it was always of interest for me personally, whether I was covering consumer or not. So I was already spending time in that space, whether it was initially, you know, through kind of food tech, vertical farming, alternative protein, and so on while at the bank, but then switching to Beringia, switching to venture, expanding that to, you know, energy tech, to biodiversity, to climate reporting, just going much, much wider. So that background was helpful just in transitioning to looking at new sectors.
Yeah. And I mean, from your perspective, do you have a preference? Like, which baby is your favorite, like, between consumer and B2B?
I wouldn't say so. I don't have a favorite. Probably now I do tend to spend more and more time in B2B. Mm-hmm. So that becomes natural. But ultimately, I like the fact that I'm a generalist investor. And, you know, you can find phenomenal companies in both of those. And I like the flexibility of being able to move between both.
I mean, there's always been an argument on this podcast in the past with others. You know, there are those that, see the generalist investors see more and therefore are potentially able to take bets on really extraordinary companies, whereas specialists obviously see a very narrow range but can add a lot of value into their thinking on in terms of investment, also in terms of supporting the business as it goes through its journey. I mean, like, do you have an opinion on that? Like, you know, do you think generalist investors, I'm putting on the spot here, but do you think generalist investors, are a better bet than maybe more specialists or vice versa?
I mean, it depends from what perspective you look at the sector. Like, if you think about fundraising as a fund, I think LPs might like more and more kind of vertical investors or people focus on a specific niche, because it kind of helps you fundraise. Two, you're going against the big tier one funds who are mostly generalist. It's really hard to compete. So that's part of the equation. But then if you look from an investor perspective, and you mentioned power law, you want your funnel of companies you look at to be as big as possible, right? Like, by default, if you become a specialist, you narrow down very quickly. It means, you know, if there will be two generational companies within that time period, within your five years of, or even 3 years of deploying the fund, and out of two, one will be consumer, you only have a chance to back one, right? So ultimately, you want to get the widest access possible. But I understand why there are specialized funds. And I believe they add much more value at certain points to certain companies. But yeah, I'm sitting here in a generalist hat, so I'll be, cheering for generalists.
Yeah, your team generalist. I mean, look, I'm a generalist as well. I completely get it. But I think there are probably some sectors where it does make sense to have some specialist expertise or specialization within the team. Like, I'm thinking about things like bio or,
100%. Deep tech is very specific. Yeah. Like, non-generalists can tell me that they can do biotech or something extremely, extremely specific. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very tough. And I mean, one of the things that I think, you know, generalist investors, to your point, right? Like, the funnel is a lot wider. You see a lot more stuff. Therefore, you have the ability to take, you know, more bets. So you can be slightly less, your funnel is less concentrated. Therefore, you have those bigger opportunities. But I wonder whether ultimately, you know, even as a generalist investor, you end up specializing in certain sort of sectors, right? Because, for example, you know, at the moment I am seeing a lot of climate / life sciences / deep tech deals kind of coming through, which means, and they will be coming across your table at Beringer. Like, there's just no doubt that, you know, you will be approached by founders looking to raise. So does there come a point where even within your generalization, you start specializing a bit further?
Yeah, definitely. If you think, you know, if we think through fund level, then you're a generalist. But then if you think within, like, investor level,
you're specialist.
You start specializing, which is why I'm spending most of my time in those areas, right? I have colleagues, we all will call ourselves generalists, but I have colleagues who spend most time in B2C and consumer, which we do quite a lot of.
Yeah.
And then there are people who tend to start specializing. So yeah, from a fund level, you're all generalists. I think ultimately, as an investor, you do start specializing. I wonder if it makes a difference at different stages. Probably at very early kind of pre-seed, you do not specialize
too much. It's less relevant to be a specialist. I mean, like, it may be in terms of getting, so if it is very novel technology, you may need some specialization to be comfortable with the technology, but in terms of, you know, at that point it's a blank piece of paper. So actually, you know, really it's just about guidance. Whereas once, you know, there's progression in that business, that's where the specialization kicks in. Like if, you know, and that's where they would potentially start looking for more specialized or specialist investors, right? Because at that point they need support with introductions or regulatory approvals or whatever it might be, right? Like whatever specific issues they may be coming across, right? But it's hard to say, for example, like the other way of looking at it is like, you know, with B2B SaaS, for example, you can only be there's no point being a specialist, right? Almost, because actually fundamentally, if there is a problem to which you've built a solution, you don't need to be a specialist in banking or in manufacturing or in whatever to understand, to your point earlier, how that B2B, like how that B2B SaaS business is functioning, right? Like it either is following the trend that you would expect and building ARR and NRR and so on and so forth. But you don't necessarily need specialization. In fact, if you were a specialist in B2B and B2B SaaS, I'm not entirely sure what you would be specialist in. You'd be a specialist in the software or, you know, or what, right?
I mean, it's actually an interesting point in that, right? Because the question is, why do you specialize? Mm. Is it to win a deal and
is
help?
It to make a better decision, or is it to support?
Exactly. Exactly. Your job is to find the right businesses. Is being specialized helping you pick the better business in that specific field? Yes or no? That should be the most relevant thing. And then we'll probably get to a point, but ultimately, if you're specialized, you can be also potentially more of a value add for the business from a board perspective, if you participate in the board, right? If you're involved there. Or I would say some of the specialist investors will have a network of LPs.
Yes.
Who are potential customers for that business. Yeah. And let's be honest, the kind of most value add you can bring as an investor to the table is bring revenue.
Yeah.
Like bring revenue. That's the most important one.
Yeah. In fact, we had Tanya Emmeling from Germany on the podcast recently, and TGIF is the fund. It's definitely not TGIF. I think it's GTH, if I'm not mistaken. Apologies if I got that wrong, guys. But essentially, you know, their whole LP, so they are a commingled fund of public and private capital, but the private capital is predominantly from German enterprise or corporations, which means that they become reference clients, or they, you know, or they can support the business in testing phases, et cetera, in a way that otherwise, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have access to. But the other thing I was just as you were saying all that, I was thinking, but you know, when you're a specialist in something, it's also harder to get to a yes, because you know, because you've specialized in something, you know where all the pitfalls are, you know where all the problems are, you know where the issues are. And it's much easier, again, to our earlier point about finding reasons to say yes versus no. I think it's much easier to find reasons to say no when you're a specialist than when you're not, because when you're a specialist, you're kind of embedded in the experience that you've had. Whereas if you're a generalist, you don't have the burden of the experience that you've had. So you can potentially see beyond, you know, the obvious, and I guess, you know, create a framework that can not prove, but you know, that you can get comfortable around the long-term potential for a company that you're investing in.
Yeah, although I wouldn't underestimate generalists or non-specialists becoming experts in a sector while you're working on your diligence and diving into a sector. I think, yes, you know it. If you're a specialist, you kind of know upfront what you're looking for. Mm. But maybe it does blur your vision a little bit as well, right? Mm. Just coming in, maybe not cold, you never come cold, right? But coming in outside in and understanding the sector you're looking at or a specific part of, I don't know, industry this business is actually working in, it might be helpful to come outside in. And then ultimately, you know, I will be speaking with specialists while I assess that business. I will be having calls with experts. I will be talking with ecosystem. Yeah. I will be exchanging notes with specialist investors. So ultimately, I can gather that information to build my investment thesis and ultimately make a call, right? Yeah. So it's not black and white.
Yeah, yeah. It never is. It's not binary, right? Like, it's not an either or. So switching tack for a second, right? We've had Fred Destin on last year, you know, and we had a very, very sort of long conversation about how VCs should operate on boards and so on. But as someone that's relatively new to the VC world, I guess, how have you developed your skills and confidence in board roles? And what sort of strategies have you found effective in overcoming any kind of imposter syndrome that you might have faced?
Yeah, by the way, great two episodes with Fred. Really, yeah. really enjoyed them.
They were fun to record, for sure.
Yeah. I bet. look, for reference, I'm involved with 6 portfolio companies. I have 4 board director seats and 2 board observer ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this imposter syndrome is there 100%, right? You just can't avoid it. I would say first thing, you know, it's not like venture is my first job.
Yeah,
I've done other things. I've seen other things. So it's not like you come in cold, like, I don't know, straight out of uni and then suddenly you sit on a board. 1, 2, while academic, my background is in corporate finance covers corporate governance as well. I've seen it from a big public company's side, which is obviously very, very different, but at least kind of the frameworks you're working around.
Yeah, they're always the same. Yeah,
they're very similar, yeah. Right? So that helps a lot. 2, you know, I was very lucky when I joined, I had the opportunity to shadow to an extent or be an observer with some of the partners in the firm. Mm. And ultimately you're a sponge, right? You go in, you listen, you ask, and you take out as much as you can from those board meetings, from those calls that you can get. Mm. Plus you learn also from other directors on the board, right? Mm. And whether those are any decent and experts in specific industry, whether, you know, they're other investors, you learn from all of them. That was definitely incredibly helpful before I step into my first board role, right? I've seen how things are being done. I think it's a learning, you know, it's an experience, it's a journey. It will take years before I feel comfortable to say, yeah, I'm a good board member to an extent. Second point is, I think you have to understand kind of areas you can add value in,
yeah,
and which you feel comfortable with, right? And areas where you don't, and where you have to understand who else is around the table in a board meeting who can actually address those points, right? It's like, you know, when we talk about fundraising, when we talk about exit, when we talk about budgeting, yes, those are areas I can help a lot. But if we talk about, say, I don't know, some specific sales process or issue with pipeline or marketing, there hopefully is someone else who can be more helpful in the room to the founder and to that specific problem. Mm. And that brings us to the point that I think Fred mentioned as well, right? It's more about listening. Mm. It's not about, I mean, especially initially, you do feel like, I have to prove my value here. I should say something to an extent. And I think Fred in that episode also mentioned, like, sometimes you get people who will just say, like, or speak up to say something. That's not what it is, right?
It's more presence felt.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. 100%. Yeah. It's more about listening, and it's all art of asking questions. It's like you can specialize, I don't know, do a masterclass in how to ask the right question, how to kind of help someone think about the problem outside in. It's fascinating. That helped. That helps a lot. Some other smaller things that I found helpful were doing a one-on-one before the board with the founder. There are topics you want to cover up front, probably not in a board setting. Mm-hmm. Second one is, I try to do annual appraisals or feedback with the founder. Let's just, you know, we work on those boards. Why not just give each other feedback? Like, yeah, what do you think worked? What didn't work? It's not common. A lot of investors would hate to do it. Mm. But I think that's what keeps you kind of honest in the job. And the last one, which I really like, is, and I don't think, you know, a lot of people use it, and obviously if you're in a board from corporate governance perspective, you have a board member hat, and that's the only hat you're wearing. But outside of the board and kind of around it, what helped me is, like, pick your hat. Mm. Like, when I have a relationship with the founder, what helped is saying, hey, now I'm wearing Piotr hat. Like, Piotr thinks X, Y, and Z. Mm. But if I were an investor hat, this is what I would tell you. Mm. If I'm speaking as a board member, this is the response. It helps you kind of position the conversation, keep that maybe not intimate, but relatively close and to an extent, if possible, vulnerable relationship with a founder, which I love to have. Mm-hmm. And navigate like those points where, you know, sometimes what Piotr thinks and what my IC thinks and what me as a board member think are three different things.
I think you touch on a really important point, right? Which is, you know, I think about this a lot, right? Mm. You know, as an investor in a business sitting on the board, you are there both to help. Well, you are there primarily to direct and assist the executive to make the right decisions. But let's face it, you're also an investor in the business. So you are also trying to protect your investment, right? And therefore, there is always a risk of some conflict between those 100%. Two outcomes, right? And I've seen that play out many, many times. And I think that, you know, having the ability to take that step back and be vulnerable, as you say, and say, well, okay, if I were in your shoes, this is how I would approach it. As a board member, this is what I would think about. And as an investor, these are the things I'd be thinking about. And if nothing else, what that does is actually helps the founder contextualize their decision from the viewpoint of different stakeholders. Because the other thing that I think that it's really important to understand is that, yes, a board of directors will sign off on certain decisions, but they aren't there to replace the executive. The executive has to make the decisions. Ultimately, the board of directors is there to guide, hopefully, and to support and to provide additional context. And if that is what's happening, then hopefully the executive can go away and make the right decision. And it may be completely different to whatever was discussed at the board or in terms of, the strategy that, you know, Director X might have taken, but with the context and with the opinion of various, you know, board members or advisors, hopefully you can get to a more well thought out, considered decision than, you know, had you not had that at all. And yes, look, I mean, I've sat on board since I was 27, and, you know, I don't think I've figured it out fully yet. I would like to think that I'm now a better board member than I was then. And I think I am. But, you know, I also know what lane I'm good at and what lanes I'm not good at, right? And exactly to your point, you know, thankfully, because I have a background in finance and in commercial and in a couple of other areas, I can input into a bunch of stuff. But, you know, there are things like, so if I were to be on the board of, for example, a life sciences company, I can't talk about strategy, you know, from that perspective. I can definitely talk through, you know, commercial and risks and, you know, expansion and potential sort of opportunities, but I can't talk about the science, for argument's sake, right? So I think it's important, and, you know, exactly you said, I think Fred raised this and said this, you know, quite well. Know what you're good at, and, you know, don't try and be all things to everybody, because you can't. And we see that a lot in the US, I have to say. Like in the US, you know, if you go on Twitter, you have VCs that essentially sit there pontificating on absolutely everything as if they're experts in absolutely everything. And it's just not true, right? And not realistic to think that you can be. And I think does a disservice to founders when you try and do that, because you may end up giving them the wrong advice because you just simply wanted to say something, right, that sounded smart. Switching tack again. So interesting, I was actually at a new climate summit yesterday, hosting a panel for the London Venture Capital Network. We were talking about climate apathy. And actually, what I'm going to ask you now is one of the things that came up we talked about quite aggressively, I would say. So, you know, climate tech presents unique challenges, especially with the kind of massive capital requirements and government financing structures, which tend to favor incumbents. So how do you think new entrants to the space should approach this? And equally, as a relatively early stage firm, how can you get sufficient capital into these companies to at least get to some form of proof of concept? One of the, you know, panelists that we had literally said, look, I just won't even talk to VC now because, you know, he's building something in the hydrogen space. You know, it needs $500 million of capital to get off the ground and running, or it needs a couple of hundred to do this, but at the same time has contracts worth a couple of hundred million, you know, in the pipeline. So, you know, it is that real tension between, obviously, some projects require massive capital, and venture isn't necessarily the right solution for that. So, yeah, how do you think about that?
Yeah, definitely. And just taking a step back, it also depends how do you define climate tech, right? Because we jumped here to the kind of capital intensive part of climate tech, which probably, or not even probably, but will have the biggest impact on the future if you think through a human living on a planet kind of perspective. Other than that, I mean, climate tech is really, really wide, right? Most of the time, I'm focusing on...
It could be carbon trading.
Exactly. There can be marketplaces. Yeah, sure. I mean, look at Gorilla, right? Yeah. Like, they're selling to energy and utilities. How I think about it more is, and that's probably for most of my investing, is finding the underlying tailwinds in the market. And this can be within climate tech, if it's driven, like how renewables on the grid impact the market, where do they create opportunities, how smart meters rollout creates a market, who will benefit from that, who will have a problem because of that, right? What regulation is coming online, what will that mean for companies in terms of reporting? And you had a ton of companies doing carbon reporting. You have now a number of companies looking into biodiversity reporting.
Which leads to a question in and of itself, like, how many of those do you need, right? Like, and I know
100%, right?
Because I on the one hand, I don't think it's a winner takes all market, but on the other hand, it feels very fragmented.
Yeah, in the same way, how many kind of food delivery companies do you need, or Ubers out there?
Yeah, it's a running theme on this podcast. How many 15-minute grocery deliveries do there need to be? Yeah,
exactly. So it's a little bit similar. Going into this kind of capital intensive part of spectrum, it is very tricky. It's not all venture game. Like, not all business, not even climate tech and capital intensive in general, not all businesses should be using venture backing. So that's the first point. And then going to capital intensive ones, I think you have to think upfront through a kind of long-term framework. You cannot plan for the next half a year, year and a half, 2 years. You have to think what will be in 5 years, how much money I need, and how I will get there. There is a very helpful kind of community project that Contrarian Ventures and EQT launched called the Climate Brick, where they give those frameworks for a capital-intensive climate projects, how you should think about it as a founder, like, even giving you steps of valuation at different funding rounds, what are the sources of capital. So there are frameworks out there that help you from the get-go think about it, which is really helpful. I highly recommend it to anyone building in that space. It's nothing new, but there have to be grants, there has to be public funding. You have to find a way to have partnerships with either industry bodies or corporates within that space, which is that kind of incumbents. Yeah, they will have to play, right? You will have to have those partnerships quite early on.
I mean, one of the problems there, and this was raised again by a couple of the panelists, is that the problem is that grants and public money tends to favor the incumbents rather than new entrants. And the problem with incumbents is they're disincentivized necessarily to do to do what needs to be done. And of course, we're seeing that in the US at the moment, with a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the US government. A lot of companies are basically, you know, rowing back a lot of their targets in terms of, you know, whether it's zero or whatever it might be, right? So I think there is a real tension there between, you know, we do need climate tech businesses to be built, to be founded, built, survive, thrive. And yes, I take your point that venture isn't necessarily the right asset class for all businesses, for sure. And I think one of the things that I think, you know, this is going back a few years, but one of the kind of aha moments I had myself was when I realized that, okay, if you think about venture not as a driver of innovation, but it's a driver of financial returns that happens to be in the innovation game, then that actually helps you understand, you know, what sort of businesses are likely to get to be backed by venture. And that's not to say that they won't ever back large scale projects, but they're just, you know, so you know, you would need to be a fund of several billion dollars to back a substantial infrastructure project. And that probably doesn't make sense for the majority of VC, let alone, you know, let alone founders building in that space. So I guess then, to your point, if it is those big projects that are going to make the difference, and yes, public money, incumbents, et cetera, all there, can venture play a role there? How would it play a role?
It can play a role, I would say, at the idea stage or very early on.
Yeah. Get to a proof of concept of some nature, but you're not going to fund the whole journey.
No, I mean, that's impossible for multiple reasons, right? I mean, infrastructure, it ultimately becomes infrastructure project. Those have different returns that don't match what you're solving for as a venture investor. You're most of the time in 5+5 timeline, which doesn't really work. So you have some funds that are started as evergreen funds, which are, solve for lower returns, two, might potentially be slightly bigger, but three, have some alignment with how the projects evolve. But I think you can bring value as an investor if you're on board with the founder by indeed helping them understand how you can attract funding for that type of business, how you think through those long-term frameworks, how you implement them. But that's on software side. I don't think you can solve it with your own back to an extent.
I think it's a tough one. I think it's one that we are, we're going to struggle with always, because, at a very early stage, it's hard to attract capital. There is a limit to how much angels can put in. There's a limit to what VCs will do. So government.
This is where it comes. About semiconductors, right? Back in the day in the States, how it all started, right? They were selling to Army. It was fully backed by government contracts. Mm. It was all public money that created
GPS, Silicon Valley. GPS, internet, all of these things,
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit unfortunate, but again, I think it's just finding the right... finding the right source of funding for those projects.
The right champion.
Are not venture.
It's interesting. I don't think it's a conversation that's going to die. So I want to talk, just before we kind of close off, you've had a lot of experience in IPOs across various markets, including Europe and Turkey, and as well as others. So what are your thoughts on the current state of the European IPO market compared to the US? I mean, again, this is a conversation I've had many times, but it's always great to get another perspective. And what are the factors that you believe are influencing companies' decisions on where to list at the moment?
Yeah, it's a well-covered topic, if you will, and everyone has an opinion. And unfortunately, probably a lot of narrative right now around negative narrative around Europe is very similar to IPO market, right? But it differs because obviously our conversation is more from a perspective for high growth tech, and that's a little bit different when you think about IPO market in the US and Europe specifically. If you are a non-tech company, right, and if you go to your advisor, so again, investment bankers do get involved very heavily in initially pitching and then working on the IPOs, right? You will ask about for an advice as a business, where should we list? And then, ECM, Equity Capital Markets team, will give you, again, not a decision, but a menu of options. Where do you want to list? If, say, you're a Polish business, right, you can list in your home market in Warsaw. Best familiarity of investors on the ground. Everyone knows the business. You would have to educate people out there. Or do you want to go to number one market in Europe, which is London? Probably often. If you're not tech, US wouldn't even be a conversation.
Of course.
If you're not 10 billion plus, and maybe, someone will disagree, fair. But if you're not 10 billion plus market cap business, you're irrelevant in the States, especially if you're not from the States.
Right.
You're probably best listing at home. Then the points that are brought up by investors and which are driving decision making, whether to list in the States or whether to list in Europe, everyone will talk about liquidity and volumes in those markets, right? They're much higher in the States than they're in Europe. If you look I think there are a lot of good initiatives being undertaken to kind of revive, especially IPO market on London Stock Exchange, but also across Europe, and they're very much needed. But what's happening in the market is not helping them. Second point is valuation. You will always optimize for valuation. If your closest peer is trading in the States, that market has best understanding of what type of company you are. You will go and list in the States, and you will probably trade at a discount to that well-trading company or at a premium, but that does not happen very often. So you want to be in a place where there are companies from your space, and that links to a equity research analysts understanding that business, investors being more willing, like understanding this type of business and willing to take more risk. And that usually, again, if we think about tech specifically, very often those are high growth, unprofitable businesses that list. And we talked at some point, you know, in this conversation about the cultural background, like of companies, say, going bust, right? Culturally in the States, that's fine. You move on to the next one. In Europe, no. And it's similarly in Europe. We don't like, I mean, we like high growth businesses, but we don't like unprofitable businesses. Yeah. Investors, it's like, even if you compare venture investors, European versus US, right? It's the same in public markets.
So those
are all things that contribute to it. And ultimately, people are picking the US market. Obviously, there are regulatory and compliance challenges as well, but those are being addressed slowly in Europe to make it easier dual class shares in the US versus versus London.
I mean, I think you said it really well. It's actually, you know, the easy way to think about it is appetite, risk, liquidity, market, you know, all of those things. But actually, it really comes down fundamentally, I think, to this question about culture in Europe. And the problem is that it becomes a self-serving cycle in that, you know, if people believe that Europe doesn't have the appetite and culture isn't willing to support, kind of certainly within tech, the high growth but highly unprofitable businesses, then they'll list in the US where they know they can do that. And then that just perpetuates the argument that Europe doesn't list these sort of businesses. So I guess, I don't know how we change that, you know, or whether we need to. I mean, like, I think we do. I personally think we need to change that. But, you know, if Europe only wants to work with kind of quote unquote bog standard, you know, steady conservative type businesses, and that's the market that, you know, that'll attract, those are the companies that'll attract as a market. And the US is attracting the others. I think you would need a significant change and shift in mentality in Europe for that to change anytime soon. And I can't see that happening particularly soon, to say the least, right?
Yeah, it's tough to see it. And yeah, something would have to break the cycle. It's
maybe one massive listing that really just...
I don't think it's, you know, up to one listing to really change it. It will have to be like quite a few things in a sequence that actually come and help unlock the market. Maybe, I mean, London should be very well placed to be this fintech hub, right? It's a financial center. And hopefully there are some IPOs coming up. Naturally, now Klarna is talking about listing in the States. It's a lost case. That would be fantastic to have in Europe. I mean, most likely in London, because it's a deeper market than Sweden itself. But hopefully there are some other companies coming up that will ultimately list in London. That will be very helpful. The other part is, you know, companies are staying private much longer.
Yeah, sure.
Which is
like been the case for like over a decade now.
Yeah, but it's a vicious circle, right? Because venture investors and private equity investors will be complaining there's no liquidity, IPO window is closed. Yeah, but we're also keeping those businesses private for longer. There is more money from pension funds, insurance going to private markets, which funds having those companies much longer as private entities. So we're not providing a pipeline of companies to the market. You know, companies used to list much earlier with a much smaller size, and it was okay. Now, very often you don't have to do it. You don't want to do it. There is enough capital out there not to do it. So yeah, it is a vicious circle because you're kind of, I mean, you have a problem, but you're also causing the problem.
you're complaining about it, but you're causing it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, yeah, because I mean, like, there's been a lot of ink spilt in the Financial Times, for example, about kind of private equity is now struggling because they're just sort of selling it on, you know, they're selling from fund one into fund two.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to mark up and so on and so forth. And that in itself is not a particularly good thing to be happening. But yeah, I think, you know, you're right. If as long as companies decide or can stay private as long as possible, why put yourself through the hassle of listing, of reporting, of all the kind of regulatory hurdles and frameworks that you have to then have to deal with? I mean, you know, we recently had a conversation with a company that was looking to list, but on a smaller market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my CFO just said to them, why are you trying to do this? And actually the founder couldn't really necessarily give a particularly good answer to that question. And you know, frankly, I think there is possibly a bit of a halo effect. Like, people want to ring the bell. They do want to say that they're listed. I mean, I get that. But yeah, I mean, like, actually, if I can stay private for longer and stay within under my own control and without the sort of external scrutiny, that's kind of attractive as well, right? I think maybe some words. I think I need to get Neil Shah back on the podcast and
yeah, definitely,
and have him talk. The last time I talked to him on here was like 3 years ago, so time to get him back on board. I have one final question just before we wrap up, and actually I'll almost answer the question myself beforehand, but. What is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is a hill that you would die on defending? And the answer that I would give is that both of us connected over the fact that neither of us were at Slush. So maybe that's a contrarian opinion. You don't need to go to Slush if you're a VC.
100%. Use it as an opportunity, right? Yeah, unpopular one, but for ice hockey fans out there, I do believe New York Rangers will make it to playoffs this year, despite being sellers at the deadline.
We haven't had an ice hockey opinion on it. Are you like, clearly you follow the sport?
Yeah, I mean, ice hockey was a sport that kind of I grew up with, as in my hometown, it was the sport to follow. And yeah, now I follow NHL quite, probably very closely.
Okay. I can't really comment on that because I know nothing about ice hockey, which sadly I have a lot of Canadian cousins. I'm sure they will berate me for that fact. Listen, Piotr, it's been absolutely amazing having you on the podcast. For our audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, on Twitter? Where can they find you on the internet?
Yeah, LinkedIn works best.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.